The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now, David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about running barefoot. Not something I'd want to do on my street.
Well, Rob, it's something that humans have been doing for 2 million years. In fact, running shoes have only been around for about 100 years, and they've only really became popular in the 1970s. And so in this study, researchers were wondering, you know, if we've been running that long on bare feet, is it better to run on bare feet? Is it possible that running with shoes on is actually hurting our bodies?
I would assume that the answer is yes, although the glass and other things that are on my street, I'm not really sure I would want to have my bare feet exposed to.
That's true. There are definitely some advantages to running shoes like the ones you just mentioned. But in this study, researchers found that there's a lot of disadvantages as well. They looked at about 200 people, both from the U.S. and Kenya, which is famous for producing a lot of long-distance runners. And they looked at people who had worn running shoes all their life, who had never worn shoes at all, and people in between. And they had them run on treadmills and things like that. And they measured how much impact the running was having on their feet and on the rest of their body. And the first interesting thing that they noticed was that people that wore shoes, when they ran, they tended to land on the heel of their foot, whereas barefoot runners tended to land on the ball of their foot. So that was sort of an interesting finding. But the real interesting finding came when they looked at what the impact of these two different running styles had on the body. And what they found is that the people without shoes on, they were seeing a lot more flex in the foot, in the arch of the foot, in the ankle and the knee, and even in the calf muscle. So the body was absorbing a lot more of the impact of the running, which is a good thing because you don't want all that impact focused on one place. Versus the people with shoes on, they were experiencing a lot more shock to their body, up to 4 times more shock than the people that were running barefoot.
So the heel-toe strategy of running around with shoes on is not so good.
Well, that's what the study seems to indicate.
So what's the solution? Is it to run differently?
Well, I mean, on the face of it, the solution is for all of us to run barefoot. But as you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of glass on the ground and other things that would make that a bad idea, at least in urban environments. Even the research team isn't advocating barefoot running because of that reason, and because it's also just one study. But the author of the study is actually a runner himself and has, since conducting the study, has begun to start running barefoot. So that may tell you something. But he says, you know, if people are interested in running barefoot, they shouldn't just go cold turkey with their running shoes. They should gradually transition to make sure that their bodies adjust properly.
Okay, so what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from feet to feathers, this next story is about whether dinosaurs had feathers, and if so, what color they were. And Rob, believe it or not, despite all of our scientific advances, we still don't know what color dinosaurs were. All these movies you see like Jurassic Park, that's just the CGI artist's imagination. And actually, people that study dinosaurs have said, we'll never know what color dinosaurs were. But some of them are actually changing their tune now that this new study has come out.
Some new evidence then.
Exactly. This study looks at fossilized dinosaurs and looks specifically at organelles, which are these tiny compartments in a cell, fossilized organelles called melanosomes. And melanosomes contain melanin. And you may know that melanin is responsible for giving us our skin color and also tanning and things like that. Well, it's also responsible for color in general. And researchers, if they do electron microscopy on these melanin compounds, these group of pigment compounds, even though the compounds themselves are not colored, if you look closely enough at them, the compounds have different structures depending on what their color is. So even though it looks black and white under a scanning electron microscope, you can say, hey, this particular tissue or this particular feather in this case must have been white, or it must have been gray or even orange.
So which particular dinosaur are we talking about here, and what color was it?
Well, Rob, for this study, they looked at two creatures. One was a Cretaceous bird called Confucius ornis. And this was a 125-million-year-old bird, and the researchers detected two types of melanosomes in its fossilized feathers, one which gave rise to a black-gray color, and another one that gave rise to a reddish-brown color. And you can see a reconstruction of what this ancient bird looked like on the site. We have a nice slideshow that has this and pictures of this dinosaur, which was called Cynosauropteryx. And this is a dinosaur that also lived in the Cretaceous period. And the researchers found that the structures of its pigment compounds indicated that it had reddish brown stripes covering the tail, and that there was areas of it that were completely missing these melanosomes, which indicates that these areas of the animal were white.
And this is convincing scientists not only of the color, but that at least for one particular dinosaur, it had feathers?
Right. And the reason the scientists say that is because all of this material they're studying would be much better preserved if it was part of a feathers. If it was part of the skin, chances are it would have decayed very quickly, would not have been fossilized well. So they're just saying just the very fact that these melanosomes are preserved indicates that they must have been part of a structure like a feather.
What are other researchers saying about this?
Well, first of all, researchers think it's really cool that we can actually perhaps get a sense for what dinosaurs look like. But this whole idea of whether dinosaurs had feathers or not is still very contentious. It's been one of the most contentious topics in dinosaur science. So the people that fall down on the side that dinosaurs never had feathers aren't convinced by this study. They're saying that perhaps the melanosomes actually didn't come from the dinosaur at all. Maybe they were just bacteria that somehow were part of the fossil, and that's what the researchers are looking at. So that particular debate rages on, but at least for now, we've got some nice, colorful pictures of dinosaurs that are more accurate than they've ever been before.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from tiny pigments to tiny particles, this last story is about tiny particles crashing together and forming black holes.
This is some sort of concern about the Large Hadron Collider?
Well, yes, tangentially. The Large Hadron Collider is this giant multi-billion dollar physics experiment happening in Switzerland where researchers are zooming particles through these tunnels at enormous speeds and enormous energies and crashing them into each other, hoping to produce new particles and potentially even something called the God particle, which would explain why objects have mass. But one concern about smashing these particles together at such high energy is that it could create black holes. And there's actually even been groups that have petitioned to shut down the LHC because they say it's going to create a black hole that's going to swallow the world. Now, physicists say that's impossible, that the LHC could create a black hole that's going to swallow the world. But it is theoretically possible that it could create these tiny black holes. But nobody had actually shown that this could actually happen. And that's what this new study is about. Can smashing these tiny particles together actually create a black hole?
So some kind of computer simulation. The LHC isn't up to speed yet.
Exactly. And this all has to do with a theory that Einstein had, which was basically if you put too much mass or too much energy into an extremely small volume, you'll create a black hole because essentially putting too much mass and energy into this very small space warps space-time, and space-time can be warped so much that nothing, not even light, can escape, and essentially you have a black hole. But again, researchers have actually never run a simulation to show that this could actually happen, and that's what they did in this study. So what researchers did was they took hundreds of computers, and they modeled these two tiny particles. They had them smash into each other at tremendous energies, and they observed, doing a bunch of very complicated physics equations, that indeed smashing these two particles together would create a very small black hole.
Is the LHC capable of producing that much energy and smashing these things together that fast?
Well, what the researchers say is that the LHC would need to produce a quintillion times more energy than it does right now to even have the prospect of something like this happening.
A quintillion? How many zeros is that?
That's a lot, Rob. It's actually 10 to the 18th as much power that the LHC will produce when it maxes out. Although there is one possibility, Rob, there is a theory that's been going around actually in physics for a long time, that there are extra dimensions of space that we can't see. And if these extra dimensions actually exist, then they could potentially significantly lower the amount of energy needed to create a black hole by smashing two particles together. But physicists say even if that happened, even if all this stuff came to pass, these black holes that would be produced by the LHC would first of all be extremely tiny, and second of all, they would harmlessly decay almost immediately, so they wouldn't pose a threat to anything.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, while we're still on the astronomy kick, we've got a story about how heavyweight stars are born just like our sun, and also a story about altruism in chimpanzees. And on Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the end of the line for Mars's Spirit rover. It's become stuck in the sand, and it looks like it's the end of the mission, although scientists say it may still have a few more experiments left in it. And there's also a story about Bill Gates getting into the geoengineering game. Geoengineering is this whole idea that we can somehow combat global warming by doing various things like launching mirrors into space to block the sun or seeding heating the ocean with iron to increase the uptake of carbon dioxide. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.